Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. We're delighted that Thomas Lux, the poet, and I use it as an affirmation, is our guest. Bill Russell?
You mentioned the rewards of it, and for a lot of people, particularly in an environment where it seems that marketing and economics seems to be the fundamental driver. This clearly is one of those businesses, I assume, that one does not go into with the notion that one is going to retire young and very wealthy to the islands. We have a friend who is a musician and who counsels students that if there's anything else in the world they can do other than being a musician, they should do it. Does that characterize poetry?
Well, most writers that I know, poets and writers, earn their living as teachers, earn the bulk of their living as teachers. That's how I've earned my living for over 30 years, the bulk of it. I wanted to be a teacher before I knew I could be a writer. Every writer has to earn a living. That's something that I happen to like and have been good at, and so I feel blessed in that way that I get to talk about poetry and I get paid for it. I'm still astonished that people give me a paycheck to talk about this thing I love. But poets do other things too, and Stanley Kunitz, for example, recommends that all poets learn other trades, learn how to do things with your hands, carpentry or gardening or, you know, farming, raising animals, something like that, and I think that's a good idea. But most poets do earn their living in the university nowadays. Some people think that's bad for poetry. Some people think it's okay. Some people think it's a good thing.
There's a tangibility and an accessibility in your poetry that, to me, is in some ways extraordinary. It is not abstruse. It is not distant. It is not overtly intellectual. It has to do with worlds that we inhabit, but the world we inhabit seen in fresh, imaginative ways, sometimes bizarre ways.
I hope so. I think one of the writer's first responsibilities is to not bore the reader. I think we have an obligation from the title of a poem to not be boring. And trying to be accessible, clear enough, direct enough, and at the same time, fresh enough, original enough, crazy enough, wild enough, that's the challenge, to try to have that balance between originality and accessibility, and that's the edge I like to work on, and I want to stay on the good side of that line, on the accessible side of that line. But we don't love poetry just because we understand it. We love poetry for the crazy stuff it does to us, and how it moves us, how it reminds us of how we're human. So we don't love poetry just because we read it and we can understand the poem. The best poems are understood not only on that kind of literal level, but also understood by the reader's body and the reader's gut and the reader's heart, etc. So trying to do both is what I've always looked upon as my mission. Be clear enough, but try to have something interesting going on, some imagination, some metaphor, some music, some things rubbing up against each other that create friction, tension in the poem, etc. And like I said, it's an art form and it's a craft, and there's a million little details that every good poet has to pay attention to, but the finished product is supposed to seem just natural and fluid. Everybody knows that a ballet dancer who can make one of those leaps like a gazelle and come down and make it look simple, they know they had to sweat blood to do that for years. But sometimes people think, well, I have language, I have feelings, I'm sincere, therefore I can write a poem, a good poem, and that's just simply naive.
Well, you talk about poems being made things.
Right.
And you mean that quite literally.
Quite literally. And this is Horace said this a couple thousand years ago. The word poet, it comes from the word to make, maker. That's the origins of that word in the ancient Greek. They are made things. They're supposed to seem, when they're made really well, seamless and fluid, and it's not supposed to be obvious that they were labored over.
You wrote a poem as your daughter, who is now a teenager, was still, I don't remember if this is the one when she was in vitro or as she was about to be born, and you say, I think it's the poem where you say, this is for my daughter to read when she is grown, right, or when she can read.
Right.
And you say, your father likes books full of facts.
Right.
And I had the sense that that is then what you have spent 30 years putting into those poems, that it's not just blather, that you're really in the real world.
It's the world. I do include the world in my poems. I read a huge amount of history and nonfiction. A lot of times my poems begin with something I read, something that strikes me as having metaphorical possibilities that I need to try to explore in writing the poem.
This sense, again, of it being made, I grew up thinking poetry had to have a certain meter and rhyme and all those things they told us in high school, I guess. And that had been very off-putting to me. And you're still saying it's something that requires craft. Is there any middle ground in that? Do I have to go off and take a class to know how to write a poem?
No. The craft should not matter to the reader who's reading for pleasure. The craft should not even be noticeable. The craft should be doing its job to help get across whatever the poet's trying to get across. But if somebody is trying to analyze what the meter is or what this rhyme scheme is here, that's going to take away from that. But all of the craft exists in order to heighten whatever the crazy stuff we love in a poem is about. And it's supposed to be more or less hidden. Just like all that exercise practice that goes into making a balletic leap look simple. It's the same principle.
I have a sense of the physicality of a ballet leap or the physicality of a baseball game, what the craft is. I have much less of a sense of what, when you say craft with respect to words, with respect to poetry, what that means. I think of it in prose as being a matter of clarity,
right,
and which includes word selection and the pacing and the structure of sentences. How does that work in poetry?
Well, in poetry, the craft is it used to be pretty. You couldn't write poetry unless they were strictly rhymed and metered, almost always iambic. Eliot said, for a good poet, there is no such thing as free verse. And I believe that very strongly, but I also don't think that poems have to be traditionally rhymed and metered to be called good poems. But every good poet I know uses rhyme, certainly variations on meter. Every word in relation to other words are where they are for a reason. Every sound is where it is in relation to another sound. Every stress syllable is there for a reason. That's what I mean. I mean, sometimes when people say craft, they just mean rhyme and meter, but there's a million variations on traditional rhyme and meter. It's all about paying attention to all these little details that are, you hope, are going to end up making something whole and full and seamless and seemingly just happening, just a guy talking. But to make it sound like that, you have to pay attention. Line breaks, something that does not exist in prose, are a very useful tool in poetry. All the different ways, a dance between stress and unstressed syllables, doesn't have to be in meter to still have that dance, or in a strict meter.
There is, in your work, in many of the poems, the few poems I have read recently, there is a musical quality. In your case, my visceral reaction is it feels like jazz, up to and including the percussive parts of it. But there's a bass line, there's a melody that's sort of, mm-hmm.
Is he making that up?
Is there a correlation between the musical instincts? And I'm really going
maybe. I don't know a lot about jazz, but I have heard that comparison made before, that my rhythms, et cetera, are kind of jazzy, and I certainly take that as a compliment. It's just that my poems are filled with rhyme. It's just that they don't always come at the end of lines, and they're not always what's known as full rhyme. All poets play around a lot with what's called assonance, vowel rhymes, consonants, consonant rhymes, half rhyme, off rhyme, slant rhyme, all pretty much the same things. We know, for example, we've always known that there's a pleasure in the repetition of sounds. That's why rhyme was invented.
That's why any child will do it.
Sure. But now they know that it is literally a physiological thing. They have machines like CAT scans that can scan your brain, and when you hear poetry that gives you pleasure, those parts of your brain light up. So it is a physiological thing, this need for some kind of order of music and sounds in poetry. And it can be done in ways other than just that traditional way. But by the way, anybody who wants to write seriously has to know the tradition. Stuff as well. You have to learn the rules before you can break the rules. That's just a hard fact and a hard reality that a lot of writers, new writers anyway, don't want to deal with. But if you want to be a serious writer, you have to know the tradition. You have to know the craft going back to for thousands of years, and not only in your own language, but every culture on earth has had a poetry, always, independent of each other. It comes out of some kind of deep human need. So, you know, people who want to write today, read the whole tradition and know it. Know it in their bones. I am in no way advocating, you know, not paying attention to the craft or the traditional craft.
The person who pays a great deal of attention.
Can we, when we come back, we've been talking in an abstraction, and we've read Tom's work. We've heard Tom read it.
When we come back, we
Could
will
we
let the
Tom?
Musical Thomas Lux read some of his poetry, if he chooses. Please be with us when we return in just a moment.